Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hi, listeners. I'd like to invite you to visit our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, download our ebook on organic gardening basics, and get started on building your very own organic oasis today. Welcome to today's episode of the Organic Gardener Podcast. I am super excited to introduce my first guest from the Aero Conference that I went to, that I told everybody about, the expo and annual meeting. And Patty was actually one of the very first people that I talked to there. And right away, I knew she had to come on the show. She is an extraordinary educator who is changing how the kids eat in the cafeteria, how students learn. I mean, she teaches agricultural. Okay, I'm just going to let her tell you what she does. She does much better than me. Welcome to the show, Patty.
Well, thank you for a wonderful introduction, Jackie. Glad to be with you today.
Yeah, I'm so glad to have you. So, you know what? I was going to tell myself that I need to put the date in the show. So today's October 4th, 2015, if you're not listening this week or if you're listening in the future. And so go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, well, if we start with now I teach 7 through 12 in agriculture classes at the Hinsdale Public School, which is a little tiny school in a tiny community out in the middle of the High Line on US 2 out in eastern Montana. And so that's what I'm engaged in currently. I've been doing that for 8 years. And when I started, I decided I had to have a greenhouse, but I have been in the community since 1992, ranching and running an outfitting business and really doing business stuff, along with raising a child, that I knew the school board would not allow a greenhouse. And so I did a bunch of research and come up with a passive solar design in a few other states, and I decided I was just going to design my own passive solar. So we constructed a root cellar that's off the grid. And when I took the school board, I had already secured funding through grants and dropped the brainstorm on them and already had it okayed by the groundskeeper that it was going to be all right to put the structure where we wanted. So that is actually what started my journey in agricultural education, but teaching kids how to grow food with the passive solar greenhouse.
Okay, do you want to tell a listener, kind of explain what passive solar means?
Yes, passive solar means we're just collecting the energy from the sun. So we have no mechanical, we're not storing the energy, nor are we wired to use energy. So it's really on the pitch of the angle and its location on the earth. So we're like 2 degrees off of due south in a really steep angle on the glazing wall to collect all the winter solace we could possibly collect. And then that sun comes through that I think it's 12-foot glazing wall, and it comes in, hits water barrels. There's 20 water barrels that are full of contained water that are black, and that sunlight hits those water barrels and heats up those barrels. And then the whole building is a 6-inch wall constructed just like a house that has no air gaps in it as best as possible. It does have one window and a door with the windows for cross ventilation during summertime, but in the wintertime it is all closed up. So then that energy is contained in that water. Then at night, when the air temperature drops below the temperature of the barrels, that energy is radiated back into the building and keeps the building relatively warm most of the winter. So it's off the grid. We do have a backup solar heater, all runs on passive 2, and a passive solar vent that vents out when it gets too hot, kind of makes a chimney effect and pulls heat out when we're too warm. And so it's more or less on autopilot without any expense.
Okay. I guess I kind of got a little bit confused between the greenhouse and the root cellar. Like, is it all one?
Oh, yeah, no, two completely different things. Okay. The root cellar is a whole different project that was just completed last year. The passive solar was built in 2000, 9:10.
Oh, okay.
So it's actually in the center. If you look at pictures on our Facebook site or anything, it's in the center of our outdoor classroom, the passive solar greenhouses.
Okay. No, the root cellar, you told, is buried into the side of a hill or into the ground, right?
Yes.
Okay, and then the solar greenhouse is like an actual greenhouse up on above ground?
Yeah, but the passive solar actually was built like a house, so it would have been a 5 or 6 foot crawl space if we'd made it into a house, but we earthen filled that back after we built it. So we built a cement foundation dug deep in the ground that was a 6 or 8 inch wall on that of concrete, insulated concrete form. So we built it just like a house. The foundation's identical to a house for the passive solar. And then we put a water-containing, reservoir underneath the ground. And so that also is part of our heat sink, too, because that's holding energy from that water warming up during the summer and then radiates in the winter. But that's just part of the heat sink of the passive solar greenhouse. And so it looks like it's all above ground, but a lot of its working components and why it works is under the ground, too.
Can I
ask? But the root cellar. Yeah, go ahead, Jackie.
How did you learn how to do this?
Well, I come from a working farm where that we just work with our hands and we just do it. And I guess I was never schooled that you can't do something. So I always take the viewpoint that I'm going to do something until I prove to not be able to do it. So we just do it.
Okay. Okay, and then you were talking about the root cellar?
Yeah, the root cellar, everything evolved after the passive solar greenhouse because we built the outdoor classroom, the agricultural kids did, to teach other kids how to grow food because I was not in the school system long and recognized that the kids had no idea how to grow food. In fact, they didn't even know what plants were what, and they didn't know potatoes were growing under the ground, and so I'm like, wow, we've got to get to teaching kids how to grow food. So, one thing evolved from another to another to another. So along the way, we built a no-till garden to grow just mostly production food for this cafeteria after I convinced the cooks that they could actually serve local food, which started by asking them what they would like to serve, which was cherry tomatoes, because that's the simplest given thing that you could possibly get a cook to serve is a container of cherry tomatoes because we actually pick them, wash them, and deliver them, and then all they do is rinse them and put them on the salad bar. So that was our beginning relationship with the cooks in the outdoor classroom and actually turning into a full-blown farm to school where we're actually, whatever we grow, we eat now, and it's served in the school. But that was a 5-year building relationship that we're still building on.
Okay.
The root cellar led to why we got to the root cellar was, okay. Wow, now we have all this production because we got 3 different gardens in town, including the outdoor classroom. You know, ones where older people have give up gardening and would say, hey, we'll take that, and then we turn it into a no-till, no-chemical garden. And then we grow food in it. Well, and then we started having extra winter squash, potatoes, and onions, stuff that we could store, and we're like, we need a root cellar. So we wrote some more grants, and we come up with a design, and we went for it again, and it is completed and running like clockwork, and it's in the back side of the hill that overlooks the Malk River on the school property that's right outside the agricultural education shop door. If you was to drive by it or anything, you wouldn't notice that anything was there other than some pipes coming out of the ground and a little tiny solar panel to give us light because that building's off the grid, too. We didn't even hardwire it for electricity. So the lights we do have down in the cellar running off of solar.
Awesome. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I always do like to start the show kind of asking about your very first gardening experience. Like, who were you with? Like, how old were you? Were you a kid, an adult? What'd you grow? like just to kind of get to know you a little. And now you're not originally from Montana, right?
No, I'm from Southern Michigan.
Okay.
And I've got vivid memories of my first food experiences because of what we're all about. My family grew a fruit and vegetables, and we sold them right in our own garden. And then we had a farm, and we raised our own beef animals and raised all the feed those animals needed. And so my whole life evolved around growing food, and it's all I could think about. When I was in school, I was an extremely poor student, and I spent most of my time daydreaming about what was going on at the farm. So,
okay. Well, that's interesting. So how did you end up in eastern Montana from Southern
Michigan?
That's
another,
is that kind of a similar climate or no?
No, nothing to do with the similar in climate whatsoever. Michigan is zone 5-6 and very tempered and misty, cloudy weather a lot. And actually can grow most anything there, from peaches to blueberries to obviously the corn and soybeans that have inundated its fields lately, but raspberries, all kinds of things. And I remember picking sour choke cherries as a child in the orchards, and going and picking apples in the orchards when they were going to make them into apple cider. And that was always a big event in the fall. You know, they'd have pumpkins out front and all these great big crates of apples, and we'd go inside and you'd smell the cider and the sugar donuts. They sold sugar donuts and cider we ate together. It was just phenomenal. But I would now, as an adult, I'm like, why would you mix those two items? But it was just a Southern Michigan culture of food and what you did there.
I remember some of my fondest memories as a kid are going to this place called the Jericho Apple Cider Mill. And they would have these jellied apples, but we didn't get those very often. We usually got my parents would get apples, and then cheese and crackers was our big, and then we'd go for a nature hike. And there was this cute little farm near there that had like animals that I could actually see, like with a barn where we would eat an apple before we went on our hike too.
Cool.
But donuts and apple cider, I don't know, sounds good to me.
Yeah. But my first memory actually is in the strawberry patch that my parents grew strawberries, and we would have these 3-foot, 100-foot row of strawberries. And
oh my goodness.
I was about 8 or 9, and I can remember sitting on the hill on the cool, damp sand, and my fingers were all pink and a little sticky, you know, and smelled really sweet and just radiating of strawberries everywhere. Because then we picked ripe strawberries, and they were unchanged by the modern agriculture, and so they were full of juice and flavor and just phenomenal. And we were picking them into these wooden quart boxes, and we'd have to pick 12 of them to make a flat. And it was my first job of getting paid, and I got paid 5 cents a quart to pick strawberries. And wow, did they ever taste phenomenal and be full of juice. That is not something that you can experience in the current modern grocery store. You'd have to go someplace like Rocky Creek Farm in Bozeman and pick your own in order to get something similar to that experience today.
Okay. Fresh strawberries. You know, that's funny, because you know who planted tons of fresh strawberries was this woman. I don't know if you know her, Laura Behenna, but she's the one who introduced me to the Arrow Today. She was on my show back, and she was at the conference. Her and her boyfriend, Carrie, were there, and she grew a ton of fresh strawberries in her front yard in Kalispell in the summer.
Awesome.
So, okay. So do you want to tell us what organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening means to you?
Sure, but did you want to... I felt like I better explain how I got from Southern Michigan back to Montana.
Oh, yeah, that's
somehow.
Right.
Sorry. some of this all resulted from me being bored out of my mind in high school. And so I was working for a cattle sitter, which a cattle fitter grooms cattle for other people, and then we show them in county fairs and state fairs and regional fairs all around the central part of the United States. And I started working for him when I was 14, so I just loved the cattle, the connection between the human and the animal, I guess, and the traveling. and stuff. And so that was my first real job outside of the farm. And I went to, when I graduated from high school, I was just going to do that. And they're like, no, you need to get to college. So I went to Michigan State University for a two-year program, which landed me in Grass Range, Montana at the Enbar Ranch as an internship for two summers. And so I had already traveled to Montana because my mother was adamant that we went on a big field trip every summer as a family trip. And so I'd already traveled a large percentage of the United States before I graduated from school and knew that I just loved Montana. And so when I did my internship at Michigan State, I only applied for the Rocky Mountain Front, which was only three positions. So I'm like, wow, that was crazy. How did I even find a spot to go to?
So where did you go?
Montana accepted me. I went to the Enbar Ranch in Montana out in Grass Range and learned how to AI cows. And so I was in the AI camp there.
What does AI
on
mean?
350 cows. Artificially inseminating them.
Oh.
Yeah, so I was just cowboy, cowgirl through and through, you know. And so anyhow, when I got done there, they offered me a full-time job in Montana. I was only 19 years old, and Montana was, I was living very rural, and it was quite not the place to meet anybody else. So I decided, well, no, I would need to go somewhere else. So my old boss from Michigan was in New York, and so I went to a cattle ranch upstate New York and worked there for 10 years and traveled all of the United States and Canada from that place, except for California at the time. So anyhow, that landed me in Oklahoma when they wanted to move west and start a ranch out west. And then I met my ex-husband, and then we were both moved to Montana, threw in good jobs and went out on our own and eventually got to Montana.
Oh my goodness, you have been everywhere.
And yeah, crazy.
I have to just tell you. So I have this friend who's like totally into the PBR, the professional bull riders. Mm-hmm. So I know more about cows this year than I ever would have any other time in my life. Otherwise, yeah. I would have no idea what you were talking about and couldn't relate at all. But because I've been studying PBR a little bit here and there, I know a little more about it. Oh my goodness, you've been everywhere. Okay. So, and now you're in eastern Montana. You're still pretty far from the front. If people don't know, the Rocky Mountain Front is like the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains that go all the way from Montana down to Mexico. And so the front is where you come off the plane. So you drive across Montana for hours and hours, like probably, what, 12, 15 hours to get from where you are to the front?
Yeah, we are quite a ways out there. I don't know. We are, let's see, it was a five-hour drive to Great Falls.
Oh, so maybe like 7 hours to the front.
Yeah.
Because Great Falls is only a couple hours. But anyway, so then all of a sudden you come off the plains and you see these giant mountains, and that's where all the wind comes from, too, coming out of those mountains. But just, it's an incredible view. If you've never seen the Rocky Mountain Front, it's something to experience. Okay. Otherwise, we're going to have a three-hour interview, so we're going to move on just a little bit. Tell us what organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening means to you, or organic farming maybe even.
Yes, wow. I think it's the future. And maybe not necessarily just the word organic, I guess, but the plant community and the biological life of the soil and the insects and the whole community of biological life, that is the future. Mm-hmm. It's the future to everything in my mind.
Okay. And what inspired you to start using organic techniques?
I guess mostly because I'm a mother and I have traveled a lot, and I'm more of a visionary big thinker, and I can definitely get way, way out of the box. And I see no future in anything but that.
I like that. I like all that, the mother and the visionary and thinking out of the box part. So then how did you learn how to grow food organically and sustainably?
Well, I guess it gives us a lot of necessity. And each year you learn each year what to do different the next year and stuff. And so when I was out on our ranch and raising my child and stuff, we was had really big gardens from probably an acre. One year we grew an acre of marigolds, and what a sight to see that was. But so we were always growing our own tomatoes and a lot of our own food, green beans and such. And one year I didn't have time to be out doing the traditional hoeing, rototilling thing, you know. So I just took straw bales out there and laid them flake at a time on the ground all around the strawberry or all around the tomatoes. And that fall, when I pulled those tomato plants, which of course back then I pulled tomato plants, that's what everybody had always done, and today I don't pull tomato plants, but then I pulled these tomato plants and they had like 6-foot roots because those roots raced underneath that mulch or that straw after the moisture. You know, we're extremely dry in 12 to 14 inch rainfall there in that climate and an extremely sandy type soil. So, you know, moisture was a key component to be able to be successful gardening. And so the lights come on, I'm like, wow. Why wouldn't everybody do this? So I've been covering the soil ever since. If you go by one of my gardens, people look at it and think, wow, that person does not know how to garden because nothing's tilled and most things aren't even in straight rows and the soil's covered up.
What do you mean pulling the tomato plants and you don't pull, like, I'm confused.
I mimic nature. And so the plants, especially in the no-till garden where it's not right at the school and not where people are out there every day and looking at it, you know, this is a garden that's mostly production. And so we don't take any plants away. We let Mother Nature break them down into the system. And a good way to explain it is I'll ask the students if we had any diseases in the particular garden because they go there maybe 2 or 3 times a year. To this no-till garden because it's really no management. It's so easy to take care of that we don't go there to pull weeds much or anything. So they don't go there very often, but I'll ask them, I says, do we have any disease in this garden? And they'd say, well, yeah, we had powdery mildew in the pumpkins. I says, oh, and what did we do with that? And he says, well, we took the vines to the compost or to the dump. We removed them. I'm like, well, why did we remove them? And they said, well, because the spores from the powdery mildew would get on the ground and we'd have it on other plants the next year. I'm like, okay, good. I said, do we have any pests in this garden? Well, they would say, I guess if you consider an aphid a pest, we had aphids in the sunflowers. And I'm like, well, how did they get in the sunflowers? And they said, well, the ants herded them in the sunflowers. Says, oh, well, what happened to the aphids after they were in the sunflowers? And they says, well, the ladybugs' lace wings were eating them, and the black wasp lives their life cycle with the aphids. Like, oh. So if we was to take all these plants out of this garden and take them away, where would the beneficial insects' eggs go? And the kids would say, well, they are in the egg state and underneath the leaves, and you just removed them from the site. And one kid raised his hand and says, they would be at the landfill in Glasgow if we took them out of here. Why would we take them away? So we mimic nature and we let them break down and we don't take them away.
That's interesting. Okay. So the tomato plant, you just let them like lay in their
the tomatoes are grown on fences because we do quite a bit of vertical growing because we want a lot of production. So those tomatoes are all growing on fences, and we leave them, and the other tomatoes grow up through them the next year. But they're pretty broke down come spring. You'd be surprised.
I remember you telling me about that there. That was fascinating. So they just grow up like the fence, and then the next year you just plant new seeds, or do the seeds come back from the tomatoes because they're just staying there? Do you even have to?
Well, we usually harvest the tomatoes.
Oh.
And if it's getting on toward a frost, we'll harvest them green and take them inside and ripen them inside. So the tomatoes aren't dropping too many seeds on the ground, although once in a while you get a volunteer. But we transplant plants into that fence row. We grow the plants in the passive solar greenhouse in the spring.
Of course. What am I thinking? Okay. So do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year?
Well, I can tell you about a event that made things not grow so well. And then I can tell you genetically what came back from that. We had a hailstorm that that destroyed most things to the ground, except for the strongest of corn, which only made the corn only be left with stalks. And so we had planted a lot of new plantings this year, which is in what we call the edible schoolyard. So we had put in some new plantings on the back fence of the school at the that we consider to be a wasteland. And so we had watermelon, cantaloupe, pumpkins, and probably 10 or 12 different kinds of winter squash on the edible schoolyard, some of which was on a teepee that we've built out of rebar, which we grow vining up the teepee, you know. So after this hailstorm, everything was just beat in the ground. But the winter squash and pumpkins come back instead of normally growing the great big long vine, you know, they normally grow. These bushed out and made vines go everywhere, so they sprawled all over the ground instead of being long where we could train them to go up the teepee or the fence well. But about five or six of those varieties just have done stellar, unbelievable. Northern Georgia Candy Roaster has just done unbelievable since that hailstorm, because we're only, 60 days out, 65 days maybe, out from that hailstorm, and it's got fruit that's mature and good 12 to 14, some of them 16 inches long, and tons of them. And so I would say that was probably our most excelling plant.
Neat. I like that whole story about how it started off with a hailstorm that destroyed everything and then came back with lots of good produce. Okay, how about something you're excited to try differently next year?
Well, I guess I'm always excited in how to motivate people into doing more natural gardening, I guess, and mimicking nature and growing local foods and consuming local foods. So that's always my challenge.
Are you going to tell us a little bit about how you got the local beef in the cafeteria?
Sure, I'd love to, because I'm such a beef geek, you know. Mm-hmm. My students raise beef. That's what we're known for in our region here, is growing beef, and we sell feeder calves in the fall, and so most people only finish out the beef that they're going to eat themselves. But a couple years ago, my son was still in school, and we have our own beef, even though we're not running them on our own ranch. We run them on shares. And so him and some of his buddies, they said, well, why don't we just donate our own beef, and we'll just eat our own beef in this school? Because we had done some food miles with the younger kids, and we had discovered that our beef was coming from Houston, Texas. And I know quite a bit about the beef industry, and I'm like, wow, we are eating like Brahma beef, which is the worst beef in America, in our school system. And I'm like, wow, this has got to change. This is not going to happen on my watch. Well, so the older kids that were in school at the time could feel my passion, and they were beef kids, and they're like, well, let's just eat our own. To heck with all the rest of the stuff. So that stemmed from, let's try to figure out how to do that. Well, and then we run into policy of where it had to be slaughtered and blah, blah, blah. And so it turns out that it wasn't economically sound business for us to even donate the beef, because we would have had to drove it all the way to Chinook. So somebody would have had to take 2.5 hours to drive one of our beef all the way to Chinook, and then them come back, and then wait 2 weeks, drive back there with a freezer unit, which we don't own, and then back again. And then when we get it here, we had no place in the school to store it. And so it was just problem after problem. And so I thought, well, the easiest way to solve this is we'll just buy Montana beef. And so I call up Katie Bark, who's she's the head of team nutrition, nutritionist in the state. And she and I have become wonderful friends. And we had already had a long relationship before the beef thing come up. So she says, well, we can get it processed. We can buy processed meat from Bear Paw Beef and Chinook and then feed it to the kids in school. So that's what we've done. And so we've done that ever since, which this is now, I think, our fourth year of feeding the students Montana beef. Well, and the beef is just phenomenally good. And so about the second time the cooks served it, I kind of make a round through the cafeteria, just check on the cooks at the end of the day, see how things are going. And they were so excited, and they run over to me and said, Patty, we served 100% today because of the beef meal. And I'm like, yahoo! And I had no idea what that meant, but I rejoiced with them. And I went to the secretary. I says, what does this mean, we served 100% today? She's like, well, that means we served 100% of the population to the school today. And I must have had the most dumbest look on my face. And I'm like, we don't do that every day because there's no place for them to eat. And she's like, no, we've never done that in my 16 years of working here.
Aww.
And I was just heartbroken. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. And so from then on, I become extremely passionate about getting good food in school. And the beef is a given here because the kids love it, and it's really good beef. We went from wasting about 90% of the beef product that was serving to now having zero waste in the cafeteria on a beef dinner. In fact, there's a picture of the waste can on our Facebook site that all it's got is milk cartons in it, because there's no waste on the day that we serve beef in this school.
I like that story, just the milk cartons and the garbage. And you kind of told me a little bit at the Aero Expo about how you would look in the garbage and see what was in there and how full the cans were, and then things have changed, so now that there's pretty much milk cartons in there only. So now, yeah. Are other school districts getting Montana beef from Chinook too, like hopefully the Chinook school district and others? Cool. Okay, well,
there is. In fact, I think they can get through Cisco, so there is. It's starting to catch on, and it is a little more expensive, but when you look at the big picture, it's the only way to go, because if we're not wasting it, right, that should be the ultimate. So I try to get people to think about becoming part of the solution instead of being the problem. Well, and food waste is part of the big problem. You know, we're wasting, according to Jonathan Bloom's book, The American Wasteland, we're wasting 55% of the food that we grow in America. And I'm like, that's not acceptable. And that makes me just fighting mad. But that has to stop. Mm-hmm. And so I try to make sure that we get to understand that high-quality food that's grown locally is better for us nutritionally, and it's the soundest, smartest thing to do, no matter the cost. And eventually the cost will balance out, because if you could figure the cost of the trucking and the miles and the energy it took to do that, to get that beef here. That beef meal that we did the food miles on had 7,334 miles in it. And it was all food that we could grow right here in Montana. It had beef, mashed potatoes, a wheat dinner roll, a carrot, a green bean, and an apple on that meal. And it took that many miles to get that meal to our school. Just unacceptable. And so now we've got those miles down to less than 900, because we can't serve our own beef in our own, out of our own close local butcher plant yet. But that's all policy that's in the way. But that's still a major, major improvement over the 7,000 miles.
I'll say that's crazy. Because especially Montana is such a beef and agricultural state. You know, we have huge fields and tons of farmland, and also cattle grow here, and that we're not eating our own cattle.
Yeah, we're a net exporter, unfortunately, and most people don't recognize that, you know, that Montana exports most everything out of state. And I think the numbers are even more distorted than the statistics show, that we export everything out except for a small percentage that's processed in the state. And then we bring it back as processed product to eat it in the state. And so, our food thing's all messed up, and we're going to need to make some major changes.
All right. Well, you're starting for sure and have made huge changes, and especially from such a little community. And it's just going to spreading around Montana, and I know it's going to spread around the nation too. And such an important, I mean, Mike and I are both passionate about, you know, how many miles, becoming locavores, trying to, that's a big part of why we want to grow as much as we can here. So we're not transporting food from, you know, South America or even from, you know, California and Florida and different things, and trying to eat, you know, things that are in season. Instead of eating watermelon in the middle of winter in Montana.
Right.
So, and we actually, we just cut into our first watermelon and cantaloupe that we grew this year just today. And the cantaloupe was so good. I didn't try the watermelon yet, but because the one that we did cut into wasn't quite ripe. So we'll have to cut another one. But yeah, so exciting to be able to grow that here. We got some cool seeds from... one of my guests talked about this guy, Bill McDorman, who has a seed saving thing now, but he had collected seeds from like Siberia and that are especially, you know, I don't know if it's cultivated, but over the years, like accustomed to growing in colder climates, and they've been in the Rocky Mountains for a while. And so those finally worked. So we actually got four. They're pretty little. They're like the size of between a baseball and a softball. They're not like the huge ones you would see in the store, but oh, so good.
Yeah.
And fun. Okay, so what do you want to talk about next? Do you want to tell us about something that didn't quite work as well as you thought it was going to work this season, or?
We had great luck with the plants as far as, we didn't, I guess the leaf plant with the cucumbers just didn't withstand the battle with the hail. And so we have very few cucumbers, and the cooks use a lot of cucumbers. I usually supply them with cucumbers from August, September, and October, but that's been a big void. And so every time they ask, they have sad looks on their faces because then they're going to have to buy the great big old ones from the truck, and they don't have any flavor to them. But the kids really like cucumbers, and so they're always a goal for us to grow a lot of cucumbers, and we've definitely failed epically with that this year, but that's just part of the environment, so, and part of us that we have to eat something else this year.
I'm kind of curious. So what are the kids' favorite foods that they like to eat from the garden? Do they eat winter squash?
Well, we're teaching them to eat winter squash, and we grow a lot of winter squash and winter pumpkins on pie pumpkins, and so we process them in the kitchen, and we have a processing day where I invite students in and the cooks in, and we just process the pumpkins into the 16 cup bag size that the cooks need for the recipes, and we have a great time, and the kids love learning new things, and they're just so empowered because they know they did it with their own hands. And so come the day that we serve the pumpkin bars, and the cooks tell the kids that work in the kitchen that we've got pumpkin bars today, and so you could, those kids just beam with pride. And so it's just unbelievable when the kids have a hand in the production and the and processing into something that the kids are going to eat. And so,
oh, that's sweet. I have a friend who just made me pumpkin cinnamon rolls this weekend that were so good. And that's just, there's nothing better than getting kids into the classroom cooking. When I worked at Head Start, we cooked a lot with the kids. We would cook, we would do cooking project, like I think once, if it was once a month or once every 2 weeks. And it was always fun to teach them about cooking and, you know, there's so much math, you know, measuring and, you know, fractions and different pieces. I just think cooking is a great way to get kids involved. And then, like you said, if they're growing it, they're going to be more inspired to eat something that they wouldn't normally eat. So cucumbers, that's great. I can't remember kids eating very many cucumbers. The thing that drives me crazy that I see in the schools is when they bring snack and they, if you have carrots or broccoli or celery sticks or cucumbers, it always seems to have to come with ranch dressing. And so I would like to get our kids away from that thought. Because ranch dressing, on the flip side, is like the most fattening salad dressing there is. And so it just, I think kids need, and I think kids will eat carrots without the ranch dressing. Especially if they're, you know, the carrots I've seen in the schools a lot come in a plastic bag. And they're like those little, and they're just not a flavorful carrot fresh from the garden. So I think that would make a difference.
They're not the pencil sharpener ones, are they?
the which ones?
They're not the ones that look like they are your little finger in front of you, a pencil sharpener. Oh my gosh, those are the worst carrots in the world. Mm-hmm. We did research on them, and they're actually the great big carrots that have went bad. And then they just run them through these processors and shave them down to the good part, and then they put preservatives on them and bag them and sell them to kids because kids like them. They're cute and they look fun. But wow, I tried to get people not to eat them.
Hmm. I thought they were just little mini carrots. The baby carrots.
No,
they're not. They're like,
unfortunately not. No.
That makes a lot of sense because sometimes they'll be really watery and just they have like no flavor to them. And you know why the kids want the ranch dressing over them, and they come in the little individual wrapped plastic bags.
And if they're slimy when you open the bag, that's bad news. That's bacteria. It's nothing good about that.
Yeah.
But the ranch dressing, and that's a pet peeve of mine too. You know, I'm trying to get parents, which it's really hard to get the parents to do it. It's easier to get the kids to do something before the parents. But if they could just look at the ingredients, and the very first ingredient in ranch dressing is soybean oil. Mm-hmm. And so unless they're going to eat a handful of soybeans, I just really don't think they should eat a product that's made out of them. And so that's a pet peeve of mine. That and high fructose corn syrup. Both products, if I was to give you a cup of soybeans and a cup of field corn, you wouldn't eat either product. And so if you wouldn't eat it in its raw state, why would you eat it in its overprocessed state that's killing us? But unfortunately, most of the adults aren't thinking. They're just kind of doing, you know?
Yeah, and I think they have, you know, kind of like that. Well, if they're feeding it, you know, if they're feeding it in our schools, it must be good. They think the schools have done the research and the nutritionists. And there's, you know, I think there's some to be said, you know, they're trying their best. But just like you said, there's money and policies and different issues. There's a really good website called, what is it, maplight.org. I want to say it's maplight.org. And they talk about where money comes from to influence our politicians, the example they talk about is them wanting to put healthy, nutritious fruit in for snacks, and everybody's going to go for that. But then they change it, or they want to put healthy, fresh fruit and vegetables for snacks and the kids' lunches, and then the food processing company lobbyists go and have it change from fresh to nutritious, and all of a sudden they can hand out, you know, like you're saying, the plastic bags of carrots. I remember the thing drove me crazy were the sticky pineapples in a plastic bag too. And then you know, that they could change it to processed food instead of fresh food that's locally grown or gathered. I think that's going to change
from the local, right from the schools themselves. If they get their local wellness committees working properly, those will self-adjust. And they have in our school, pretty much. We've really hammered away at it by getting the student's voice into the wellness committee. And the wellness committee is the cooks and myself and the health teacher, which is our PE teacher and our superintendent, and a local grandmother who's a nurse is on our wellness committee, and then student body president. And so when I talk to the student body president to get their opinion of what needs to change in the school, boy, they know instantly what they want. And so I take a big bath to the wellness committee meetings for them and make those changes happen. And so they wanted real potatoes and recognizable meat, and we've made it happen. So for the last 2 years, we've had real potatoes. And when we first served them, it was the first real potatoes that was in the school in 16 years.
Okay, and then didn't you tell us something at the conference about how there's like a rule that says they have to have one of these committees, and usually like it's buried in a filing cabinet, and so if you go to your school, you can make sure that they're enforcing this rule that needs to be there, that this committee is meeting, and then go from there?
Yeah, it's part of the federal school lunch program, so they're supposed to be functioning.
Oh, and so it's federal, so it's everywhere in this nation, not just in Montana.
If they get school lunch, there's any subsidy from the USDA, it's supposed to be functioning.
Okay, listeners, so get out there and find out what your kids are eating in their school lunches, and find out if there's a wellness committee, and see what you can do to help make sure that our kids are getting the healthiest lunches that they can get. Okay. Do you want to tell us about something that's easy to grow and generally successful in your climate?
Potatoes are very, very successful. And so we get our potatoes from the Montana Potato Lab, and we planted 5 different varieties this year. And we planted all varieties that are super good to eat, and so the cooks are excited about that. And, of course, they want the old-fashioned russet Idaho baked potato. And, of course, the kids want something cool and bright colored. And so we've come together, and we make potato salad out of the ones that are cool and unusual, and then we make russets. We grow russets for the cooks to have baked potatoes our day. And red potatoes for the mashed potato that they're cooking for us. And, wow, the kids dig them and deliver them to the cooks, and the cooks fix them. And we have little waste going on those days, too. The kids just eat it. So very successful in growing potatoes here in Montana.
What kind of colored potatoes are you growing? That sounds exciting.
Oh, they grow everything from Huckleberry Gold that's purple on the outside and yellow on the inside to purple all the way through, purple inside, purple outside, and even some blue ones, so they're blue inside and out. And then your Yukon Gold that you can buy in the grocery store. And so, yeah, they get into wild stuff, but it looks really cool in a potato salad.
Ooh, that sounds good. Huckleberry Gold. I'm going to have to try those. I'm not sure about eating a purple potato that's purple on the inside, too. Or a blue potato. That really sounds strange.
Yeah, you got to wrap your head around it.
Right. Well, my listeners might know that I'm like always excited to try everything and always got my hands in buying new seeds and new stuff. So I'll probably have something crazy going next year. Okay. How about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
Oh, you know, people talk about sweet potatoes, but this is not sweet potato country. I wouldn't attempt that. And I really want people to start thinking about improving their soils through better soil health of adding organic compost and keeping the soil covered and letting the worms and the microorganisms and stuff improve your soils, and plant tilling radishes to improve the soil rather than just add more fertilizer and water. Because if we can get the soils improved by themselves, we'll reduce the water usage and you won't need to buy fertilizers, which take a lot of energy to produce. So that should be the ultimate goal for everybody, I think, is to just improve the soils through natural practices.
I like that.
You can hear the rest of Patty's story in part 2 of this episode.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow.